Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. In recent news, we've talked about the Connecticut Department of Public Health needing to transfer close to 100 people out of a Wallingford nursing home because of safety concerns. 94 patients being moved out of the Quinnipiac Valley Center and the home that is run by the Genesis Corporation. Immediately when I heard about this story, I had to talk to someone who is familiar to you, familiar to this show, and has a very lengthy background in understanding elder abuse. And that is Paul Greenwood. He's a retired deputy district attorney. He's done a criminal prosecution. He was the head of elder abuse prosecution unit from January 1996 to March of 2018. And this was the office of the San Diego district attorney. And we welcome you back to the show, Paul Greenwood. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Hi, Melissa.
So just to remind people, Paul, how long have you been in this line of work, this practice?
Well, as you mentioned, I was actually head of the Elder Abuse Prosecution Unit in San Diego, DA's office, for 22 years. But then after I retired from that position, the passion never left me. And so for the last 4 years, I have been still trying to train, educate, promote, and basically convey the messages and also share the experiences that I've learned in the courtroom prosecuting these kinds of cases with the general public and with law enforcement and prosecutors around the country.
And in fact, that's how Paul and I got connected. He was speaking at one of the local colleges here in Connecticut, and that's how he got introduced to our show. And we're so glad to have him as a resource when it comes to elder care abuse. Unfortunately, when you hear this story out of Wallingford, I mean, you heard about it out in California. What were your thoughts on it?
Well, it is obviously a very sad reading, and it makes me wonder, number one, how many times this is being repeated in other locations all over the country. Unfortunately, the violations that we've read about, which have caused the shutdown of this particular place, are not uncommon. For example, patient neglect is a huge concern for residents, for professionals, and for family members thinking about placing a loved one in one of these places. So what I'm kind of encouraged about, though, is that the Department of Public Health there in Connecticut took immediate action, obviously highlighted the problems that were in this particular place so that others can be warned about it and learn from this tragic situation.
So let's talk about that, because I think, as you mentioned, there's only so much you can rely on when it comes to the facility workers. Now, that's not to say there aren't good facilities out there. Paul and I are not saying that. But I think it is our job, either if we are the ones entering a nursing home or we are putting a loved one in a nursing home, that we vet it out, that we do it properly, and that we avoid something like this happening. Because, again, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the situation, Paul, but we do know for a fact that three people died at this facility. We know one of them was a young woman, 41 years old. And it sounds like a couple, if not all, the instances have to do with essentially neglect, patients not getting their medications or being checked on, which is just one of the saddest realities of this entire investigation. So let's start there. What do you recommend people do if it seems we are nearing a situation where either we have to go into a nursing home or we are placing a loved one in a nursing home?
You know, Melissa, this is one of the most important and crucial decisions anyone can ever make, either affecting their own life or the life of a loved one. And so we have to be extremely proactive before we make a choice. For example, I've recommended to family members make unannounced visits to a particular place that you're thinking of placing a loved one in. Go before breakfast. Go late at night. See what kind of staffing there is. One of the concerns about this particular Quinnipiac Valley Center was of improper staffing. And then obviously, talk to the Department of Public Health that oversees the issue of licensing. Find out the track record for the facility. Has it been cited in the past for violations such as medication errors or patient neglect. Look at who is owning the facility and try to talk to upper management. You know, so many times we hear that the underlying focus for many of these owners is profit. Profit at the expense of care for the actual resident. So it pays to do your homework and don't shy away from asking the tough questions. And if you're not getting appropriate answers, then move on to look at another facility.
So give us an example, if you don't mind, Paul. What are the tough questions? Like, what do you want people asking?
Well, I do want to say, has your facility ever been inspected or investigated by the department or another agency for potential violations? What is the public record for your facility? I would also ask the tough question, what kind of background check do you do on your prospective employees? How can I be reassured that if I place my loved one in this place, that the person who is caring for that individual is not going to have a prior criminal record? How do you dispense medications? How many qualified nurses do you have in the facility? Do you have LVNs? Do you have RNs? What is the proportion of CNAs to an LVN or an RN? Those are the kind of questions. And then you say, for example, at 3 o'clock in the morning, how many staff members do you have on duty on any one day?
So that's specific. And even just getting to the nitty gritty of, hey, have you ever been in trouble before? You want to go that far. That's interesting. Yeah. That can be intimidating. But if you have that map of what you should say, it can be very helpful for people to know exactly what to ask.
That's right. And if you sense that you're getting pushback and people are trying to say, well, that's not public knowledge. No, don't accept that, because then go to the Department of Public Health and ask them, can you tell me about this particular facility and their history?
We're talking this morning to Paul Greenwood. And Paul has been on this show before. He's a retired deputy district attorney for the office of the San Diego District Attorney. And he's been in this industry for 40 years. He's been in practice for 40 years. As I mentioned, he is retired, but he now takes his expertise around the country. In fact, we got connected with him when he spoke at a local college here in Connecticut. And he's been very helpful in talking about elder abuse and knowing the signs and what you can do to be proactive to make sure your loved ones are cared for. Paul, my question is, I've had listeners, unfortunately, who have called me before and their loved ones who are in nursing homes are neglected or are not treated well, are not fed, are not cleaned. And there are facilities that I have even pointed out to our Department of Public Health or to our governor before, and they get inspected, but nothing is essentially done. And my question for you is, of course, we have a very broad spectrum, as I'm sure every state does. You've got some nursing homes where you pay a very pretty penny to stay there, and those are not the ones getting written up. And then there are some where this is all we can afford, so that's where they stay. And I think you know what I'm kind of getting at. How do you hold, you know, if you only have so many options, how do you hold nursing homes or assisted living facilities accountable when if this is all you can afford and your state may or may not be prosecuting them for doing things wrong? What do you do? What do you suggest?
Well, this is the challenge, and this is what motivated me, energized me, frustrated me for so many years as head of a prosecuting agency dealing with elder neglect issues primarily. You, as a consumer, as a resident of your state, you know that you should be able to, I think, first of all, write a letter. That's key. Write a letter to your local police chief, with a copy to your local prosecuting attorney's office, with a copy to your attorney general's office in your state, and with a copy to the Department of Public Health. Let every one of these particular agencies, from law enforcement to state level, know that you are very concerned and that you believe that what you've experienced, what you've heard about, is criminal, and you want somebody to take action. And why I always start with a letter is a letter can never be ignored. And if it is ignored, then, of course, there is repercussions from that. I always look back, Melissa, to whenever somebody in our county had an issue and wrote to my boss, if there was a file that was languishing for whatever reason, that letter would come immediately to my desk, and, of course, it would get immediate action taken. So that's what I would suggest, is document and then send a letter and follow up. And if nobody seems to be taking notice, go to the media. Go to you, Melissa. Let you tell the story, be the mouthpiece, because that is how we get action.
And it's so true, because we do live in a society right now, Paul, where it's very common to just say, well, I tried calling, they put me on hold, they put me through a voicemail. That is easy to ignore, or to say, oh, I never got the call, you know. And so with a letter, when you know and you have copies of it, copies are so essential. And remind us again, what are the four identities you want to send them to? You said the police chief of your town or city.
I would start with your... Exactly. Start with the local police chief in the city or the town where the facility is located.
Okay.
You send a copy also to the county prosecutor's office in that same county. Then I would copy the attorney general of the state in which you live. And finally, I would then copy the Department of Public Health that oversees the issues of licensing to that particular facility. And it wouldn't hurt to also send a copy to your local representative that you voted into office.
Mm. It's a good idea. So your first selectman or woman or your mayor, whoever it is, who's speaking on your town. Yeah. A lot of great advice, Paul. And again, I so appreciate you being a resource on this show and would love to have you back on. I mean, I hate that this is the circumstance that I'm having you on, but I do appreciate so much that you are such an important part of this show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Melissa. And thank you again for keeping this in the news for your audience. It is vital that they know what's going on and they know how to react to it. Thank you.
We're chatting this morning with our social media consultant, Krista Carnes. And this week, well, this has been going on for weeks and weeks. Whether you follow him or you don't, he's kind of more of a rapper, an artist that is more for the 90s and the early 2000 fans, quite frankly. Kanye West. He's probably a familiar name to you if you don't listen to his music. I'm not really a huge Kanye West fan. Not because I don't like his art or his work, I should say, but I'm just not from this era. Anyways, Kanye West, he was married to Kim Kardashian. You're probably very familiar with that name. And he and Kim, while they do share four children together, they are separated. I think they have gotten divorced or they're in the process of it. Either way, Kim has moved on. And she is dating a new guy. He's a comedian. He's very well known for being on Saturday Night Live. Melissa, why do I care? Well, because Kanye West has taken it upon himself to basically get online and essentially harass and bully and even put death threats out there towards Kim's new boyfriend. So this week, this is the news here, not the drama. The news this week is that Kanye West has been temporarily banned from social media platforms like Instagram after violating the platform's policies on hate speech, bullying, and harassment. So this is where Krista comes in. Good morning, Krista. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning.
This is one of those questions, Krista, of fair to silence people. Is that an over-dramatization? Do you feel that the platform did the right thing? What do you think about this?
Well, you know, I don't know if you heard also, based on his behavior, he was also just banned from
the Grammys,
performing at the Grammys.
Yes,
because
I saw that.
And Trevor Noah is supposed to be the host there. So Trevor Noah's been under his ire. Trevor Noah had a really interesting monologue the other night on The Daily Show saying that, yes, these are celebrities and these are, you know, people who have huge social media followings and platforms. But they're still, they're human beings behind this. And so I don't know that Instagram or other social media platforms could capture every incident of this happening across its universe. But I do think that they couldn't ignore, because there was there was definitely hate speech. It was such a clear violation of the policies.
Oh, yeah.
That they have. And oftentimes things aren't as clear cut, but it was so clear. I will note that I read that he only was banned for 24 hours. And that seems a little bit like that seems sort of light. And perhaps if he continues his tirade, then, you know, it will be longer. But they also make money on the 30 million followers that Kanye has and the 290 million followers that Kim Kardashian has. And, you know, we're talking about, like, in the social media world, for the demographic that they reach, they have a huge reach.
Yes, they do.
So I don't know that it's definitely obviously capturing attention. But I think the bigger issue is that people all over experience harassment and online bullying and, you know, potentially threats. And there is not a whole lot protecting them.
Yes, Krista Carnes. Yes, Krista Carnes. This is why I wanted to talk about this. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Kim Kardashian has all the money in the world to protect herself, protect her family, you know, and so many people don't. And this kind of mental abuse, psychological, digital abuse, however we want to call it, it is real and it is traumatizing. And there are, you know, our laws and regulations have not kept up yet. So, it is concerning. And then, you know, maybe by raising this issue on such a prominent way, you know, it will get people's attention and we can do something about it. But it's scary. It's pretty scary.
It is scary. And, you know, so let's back up. So the reason I'm giving you a round of applause is because that's what I gathered from this story. So first of all, for people who don't know, as I mentioned, I'm not really a pop culture kind of girl. I don't know what's going on in Hollywood. I don't care. So I have not personally been following the Kim Kardashian, Pete Davidson, Kanye West saga. I could care less. I really could.
Right.
You know, but from the bits and pieces I've had to hear, because I work in news, it's pretty ridiculous. It's been going on for weeks now. And some of the things that he has said to Pete Davidson, it's beyond harassment. Like I said, it has put Pete Davidson's life in jeopardy. I mean, Kanye West has threatened to find a hitman, has threatened Pete Davidson's life. He has called on his followers and his fans to go after Pete Davidson if they ever see him in public. I mean, really dangerous stuff. So the
really
first,
and really then even dangerous. He made a video where, like, somebody, like a claymation figure that was obviously representative of Davidson got, like, dismembered. I mean, it's
yes.
You know, and he's calling it art. So this that's a whole nother conversation.
That's a whole different thing. Exactly. and my thing here, Krista, is first of all, the first thing I wanted to take away from this is, are you kidding me, social media? It took you this long? It took you this long to act on something so, to me, so blatantly obvious as being harassment and being abusive to your platform. But then exactly what you said, the second thing here, Krista, is that you've got multi-billionaires. I'm sorry, these guys make stupid amounts of money. And Twitter's like, or Instagram's like, we see you, and we're going to silence Kanye West. Well, what about the little you and me's that make not billions of dollars? And we see things like this happening in schools, in workplaces. And what about those people? Okay, so I established that I don't make a whole lot of money, not billions of dollars, I can tell you that, Krista Carnes, unless you are secretly rich and you've been holding out on me. I'm pretty sure you are not at Kim Kardashian status. So what do you think can be done? You know, like what do you think can at this point be done if you have social media platforms that cancel or that silence, for example, and I do think for good reason, people like Kanye West. Or even in the past when there have been things blowing up and they've kind of, you know, taken somebody like a former President Donald Trump off of their platforms for a day or two or a week. You know, at that level, as you mentioned, with the amount of money and the amount of attention that they bring to their platforms, they're being recognized. And not to mention it takes weeks before they even are like, oh, this is a concern. What can kind of be drawn from this? Like, what can we do to say, hey, we also matter. I know we're not bringing you anywhere near as much money as these guys are, but like, I'm being harassed, or this is a problem, or my kids are at risk of being bullied online. What are you doing about it? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's all we can keep asking. I don't know how much, I mean, I think it will be a collective will. And I know we've talked about this before that, like, you know, the laws and regulations and stuff, they just can't keep pace with the technology and the algorithms and everything that these companies are doing. You know, we want them to be good corporate citizens, and we can, you know, keep calling for more and more. I think the difference, I think when it comes to celebrities and, you know, prominent people like politicians and things like that, you know, they're going to have a whole lot more rope. They're going to allow for more rope before they're going to turn something off. I think, you know, because, you know, public figures, you know, can handle more scrutiny. I mean, it's hard. It's not black and white. And because they're more public, they, you know, the tolerance is maybe different. I mean, not death threats and things like that, but like what, you know, I think it was Justice Potter, you know, way back in the day when they were talking about pornography, right? And they mm-hmm. were, and he's like, I can't define it per se, but I know it when I see it. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's that kind of gut check that people are talking about.
Right.
But I think, you know, and then what about the people that skirt really close to the line and they imply something but don't actually say it? And, you know, people are maniacal, like, sometimes. And you know, you hear about, I mean, even just on a text message or, you know, people can just, like, just barrage you to the point where your entire life is upset.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would encourage everybody, and we can talk about this next time if you want, but there's a couple of bills in the Connecticut, you know, being considered in Connecticut. One of them is aimed at trying to protect kids under 17 and under from online grooming. This is where, you know, there's a gap in the law. Like, if somebody, you know, crosses a line, you know, online, you know, with pornography or something like that, that's pretty clear cut. But what if somebody's trying to reach out to your 16-year-old and, you know, create a relationship, and you're 48, and technically you haven't done anything wrong, but you
but it's just, it's even more, just the gesture of even trying to have a friendship or have a connection with someone who's, you know, not even a third of your age. Yes,
definitely things. Yeah, and we have to be careful. But like, if it's, you know, if somebody asks you for a picture, but it's not of something super suggestive, but it's still asking. It's
just making scary, your child vulnerable, and it's putting them in a situation where they are not at the, they have not developed a brain that knows how to handle that kind of a situation.
They have not.
Correctly.
These predators, yes, and online predators, similarly to online abusers
mm-hmm.
and harassers, they know the line that they can get to that hasn't crossed the legal line.
Correct.
So they cannot. And so this is why we need to define that. There are mm-hmm. other laws bills being considered that would make verification of dating profiles more upfront and real, you know, like make sure that it's a real person and
they're transparent,
and have to verify
yes.
certain mm-hmm. transparent, because people go online and create all these phony personas. That can lead to a pattern of harassment, or at least protect people that cross the line.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are people thinking about this. It's definitely, you know, obviously children, but this is, you know, harassment of women who are trying to lead a relationship is everywhere.
Absolutely.
Right? And,
absolutely.
And if Kim Kardashian can go through it on such a public level, then, you know, we just have to make sure. I think we have to if anything started even hints of it, we mm-hmm. document it.
Mm-hmm.
Screenshot it. If you're in a relationship, don't engage, you know, and make sure that you have, you know, evidence, and you know, in some cases, file the police reports. I'm sure that there's so many people that can have experiences of trying to document this stuff
mm-hmm.
and bring it to attention of law enforcement and not have them do much. But if we change the laws, if we work to change the laws, if we find out what they are, maybe we can start to close some of this. They're like loopholes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would love to pick up that conversation with Krista. She's here every couple of weeks, and we'll continue the conversation and get some more clarity on those potential laws on the books, or at least those proposals. Krista, thank you so much for having this conversation. I appreciate it.
You best. I appreciate you. We'll talk soon.
All right. Looking forward to it. Krista Carnes, our social media consultant here on WICC. We're welcoming to the show this morning Jeanette Herron, who's the City Council Majority Leader in Bridgeport. Jeanette attended the National League of Cities Congressional City Conference in Washington, D.C. earlier this month. 1,300 attendees were there to learn about best practices for using federal investments through the American Rescue Plan Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law, as well as discuss some of the pressing issues facing cities like Bridgeport today. Joining me is Jeanette Herron. Good morning, Jeanette. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yes, I'm happy to have you here. So tell us, is this your first time going to this conference, or have you been before? What was it like?
It's not my first time. 6 years ago when I got elected, 3 months later, I joined National League of Cities in Washington. So this is kind of an anniversary for me. I got very excited at that point. I started joining their federal advocacy groups. Fast forward to now, last year I was placed on the board of directors of NLC.
Wow.
Also, I chair the large cities community. I'm the vice chair of the large cities community group that they have. So as you see, I'm very excited about NLC. It's provided me so many resources to make me a qualified and good leader as a majority leader and a councilman here in Bridgeport.
So what are some of the biggest things? As I mentioned, I know a city to city is going to be very different, but for many, I'm sure there are very similar topics. Like, for example, I'm sure crime is probably one of the most common things that I would think are talked about, not just in Bridgeport, but in cities across the country. What were some of the biggest takeaways, would you say, in this year's city conference?
Well, being with other elected officials throughout the nation, I mean, as you said, 1,300 attended this conference. They have about 2,100 members nationwide. Talking to my colleagues in other areas, they have the same problems. They're having an influx of shootings, an influx of carjackings.
Mm.
And when we start to talk about that with each other, something that would work here may not work in a village or a town.
Mm-hmm.
So we get our information together, and I bring a lot of that here, and I know they do as well. And being able to communicate with others that are trying things that have failed works for us, because then we may have to critique something, or, you know, and honestly, talking to other elected officials that are in our shoes actually helps. Those resources are endless with the NLC, National League of Cities, their staff. I mean, we can call them anytime during the day. They will give us resources. If I ask them, even when ARP came in, the American Relief Plan, I said, I need to know what the premium pay, who is doing it throughout the nation. They started giving me the reports that I requested. That's what they're there for.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, Jeanette Herron, who's the City Council Majority Leader in Bridgeport, you know, could you give us an example outside of like the American Rescue Plan? Because it's a great example what you just said. But, you know, I would imagine you can kind of bounce ideas off of other major cities across the country and apply them to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Even just one example of where you've been like, hey, here's something that we're tackling in Bridgeport. We're just not making the mark. How are you doing it in your city? And then it actually led to a solution here in Bridgeport.
Absolutely. You hit that right on the nose. Homelessness. Bridgeport has a significant amount of homelessness. So when I personally have traveled with my colleagues to California, they have probably one of the largest homeless populations in the country. Some of the things that they're doing are the bridge homes and reaching out for resources and giving resources. And that information I've brought here to my colleagues, and now we've reestablished a social service department to handle our homeless initiatives. Also, if you remember, a year ago, we did a fundraiser, and your channel was very helpful to do coats for a cause, and we were able to raise enough money to get 500 coats for the homeless on the streets, which is a coat sleeping bag. So that is information that I've brought home, and it hasn't stopped there. So we're continuing to work on that. We need to eradicate homelessness. And with COVID, it's not that easy because we're in for a very bumpy ride.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even too, Bridgeport recently in the last few months, Jeanette, which obviously you know, but for anybody who doesn't know, you guys also elected a leader to tackle homelessness specifically in Bridgeport. I can't think of her title, but we've had her on this show once before, where she literally oversees the homelessness population and ways to bridge that gap of either finding them resources or convincing them to go to a place or to use what the city has to offer, things like that. I feel bad. I can't remember her name. But that's something recent as well.
Are you talking about Adrian?
That's who I'm talking about. Adrian. Yes.
Yeah. Adrian is working with our social service department. Unfortunately, she's leaving us.
Oh, no.
At the end of the month, April. Yeah. So we're going to have to find someone else.
That role just opened in general. That wasn't a role that was here last year. So, I mean, I'm sad to see Adrian go, but I do like that role is there.
And that was part of the push that we had with NLC. Myself and my colleagues insisted that we have somebody specific for that to collaborate with all the groups that deal with homelessness here, because there are a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we want them to communicate together because we don't want to have one person do the same thing over and over and over again.
Right.
And that's been a long conversation here in Bridgeport to collaborate and work together. And with Adrian doing it, it's been a positive. You know, but hopefully we will find someone just as good. And I'm kind of partial. I love Adrian to death. We can move forward and still continue to do that work that we need to do. It's important for Bridgeport. It's important for every municipality to focus on this issue right now.
And I am curious, Jeanette, I know we're running out of time, but going back to something like carjackings and crime, for example, are these things that you share with just Bridgeport, like with just Mayor Ganim's office and the city council? Or does your information from this conference get all the way up to like Governor Lamont? Because it could be very helpful for New Haven, Hartford, Stamford, Norwalk, you know, a lot of our other cities across Connecticut.
We share our information with our Hartford delegation.
Okay.
And yes, the governor is made aware of our issues. And, you know, the one positive, I'm on the board of directors of the National League of Cities.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm privy to some meetings with the board members from all over the country. And we have delegations that do reach out. I don't know if you know, our National League of City executives were at the signing of the ARP plan. So they are hand in hand with our main officials.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Well, Jeanette Herron, we really appreciate your work that you do in the city of Bridgeport, going to Washington, D.C. now for the sixth time for the National League of Cities Congressional City Conference. And again, we thank you for taking the time to share your information with us here on WICC.
Thank you, Melissa. It's a pleasure again. I can't wait to see you in person again.
Yes.
But thank you for having me. Thank you for allowing me to talk about National League of Cities. We have to do that more because they are an amazing organization.
Well, you're always welcome here on WICC, Jeanette. Thank you so much for your time. Aquiline Drones Corporation, it's a progressive American drone manufacturer and cloud solutions company, and it's located right here in Hartford, Connecticut. We've actually talked to these guys once before. Aquiline is teaming up, though, right now with the local Jewish community to bring some relief to the people of Ukraine. And to give us some of the insight is the CEO and founder of Aquiline Drones. That's Barry Alexander. Welcome back to the show, Barry. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so glad to have you here. So what is it exactly that you are providing to the people of Ukraine?
We're providing drones and free drone pilot training, hands-on training. So essentially sending out drone hardware and also our drone pilot instructors to the region for months on end to provide free hands-on training to the civilians of Ukraine.
That's unbelievable. So how many drones?
We're going to start off with about 40 commercial-grade drones. And, of course, we have a system-wide campaign beckoning the support of the business community and individuals as well to help us bolster that effort and amount of drones we send out there. Eventually, we want to send in excess of 1,000 drones, but 40 is a good place to start.
And how are you providing the training, Barry? Are those people who are physically flying over to Ukraine to teach them, or are you sending manuals or videos, or how are you doing that?
That's correct. We are sending individuals over to Poland.
Wow.
Working with some ground support personnel, out there, close to the Polish-Ukrainian border. And they should be there for months on end, or as long as it takes to, get as many people trained as possible. We're committed to the effort, and the effort is well underway.
And I'm curious, Barry, what exactly can people use the drones for with the current situation that they're living in right now with the attack from Russia? What can these drones specifically be used for?
Well, to be clear, this is a humanitarian effort, and drones are used for just about anything. And in this current state, we're using the drones for delivery of emergency supplies. When seconds count, drones can safely deliver life-saving supplies and equipment to victims that are not readily reachable by humans in time. The drones are also being used for search and rescue missions, performing search and rescue missions, helping to locate missing persons, pets, survivors of an explosion or gunfire. They'll also be used for disaster management, such that equipment uses thermal cameras that can provide imagery to enhance situation awareness and those other items of interest on the ground. And also assessments of, the environment.
We're talking this morning to CEO and founder of Aquiline Drones Corporation, Barry Alexander, and the company, the manufacturing company, is actually located in the financial district of Hartford, Connecticut. But the work that they do is pretty unbelievable. Tell us, Barry, just to give us an idea, how much is a drone? How much money does one drone cost? Forget the training and all that.
The drones that we're sending over are about $3,000, and we're committed to sending the first, like I said, 40 over. But we're also asking the business community and individuals alike to support the effort. People may not be able to buy a single drone, but they could definitely make monetary contributions toward purchasing drones, and they can either send us an email at humanitarian@aquilinedrones.com or just info@aquilinedrones.com, and we'll provide a link to the shopping portal where they have multiple options of sending their contributions in.
Okay, so there is an opportunity if people want to donate to this cause, but Aquiline is going to, for sure, give the 40 drones to start.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're
giving the 40 drones to start. We're providing the transportation logistics to get the drones out to the region. We're also providing the operational infrastructure, which includes, our instructors. And like I said, they'll be there for a while, or for as long as it takes. So any and every bit of help is necessary and appreciated, not just by us, of course, but the people who are most in need. I mean, we have refugees, women and kids, fleeing on a daily basis, being shelled and dying. And that supersedes all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So give us that website, if you don't mind, one more time, or the email, if people want to donate.
They could send an email to info@aquilinedrones, that's AQUILINEDRONES.com. So okay. Either info@aquilinedrones.com or humanitarian@aquilinedrones.com, and we will provide you a link to the product page where all forms of payment. You could also send a check, personal or bank check, to Aquiline Drones at 750-750 Main Street. That's in Hartford, 06103.
And Barry, one more time, the drones and the instructors who are going to teach how to manage these drones, when are those, and when are they going over to the Ukraine, the Polish borders?
The first batch of drones should be shipping here in about a week and a half.
Wow.
Working again with the support personnel, ground support personnel out there. And our first set of instructors are scheduled to leave in about a week and a half as well.
Wow. That's incredible.
So
well,
much. Yeah. So again, much support is needed. We'll do everything that we can to bolster the effort on our end. But we're asking every willing and able citizen, business or individual, to join in the effort.
And it is a very incredible effort. And we thank you so much for your kind heart, Barry, and for the work that Aquiline is doing. And I wish you nothing but success with this mission. Thank you so much.
I thank you, Melissa, and thanks for allowing us to use your platform to get the word out.
Absolutely. Barry Alexander, the CEO and founder of Aquiline Drones Corporation, based right here in Hartford, Connecticut.